This week on the show, perhaps the biggest Game 7 Boston has seen in quite some time. Monday night, 98.5 The Sports Hub's Adam Jones will give his thoughts. Plus, the President's Trophy winner has been eliminated from the Stanley Cup playoffs. How big could the fallout be? Snap Call Sports' Craig Seiden weighs in on that. It's all coming up and more. Calling It starts right now. Welcome into Calling It. Game 7, the two best words in sports tonight. I am Alex Barth. Joining us on the phone to break down the first Game 7 in Boston sports in 3 years from 98.5 The Sports Hub is Adam Jones. Adam, how are you doing today?
What's up, Alex? Thanks for having me back.
Thanks for coming back. Well, you'd think a team that's in a Game 7, second round, they were the best team in their conference. The starting five's pretty concrete. The Celtics, not so much. Can't believe you have to ask this before Game 7. But Adam, who are your starting five tonight for the Celtics?
Well, I would not go with what I assume Brad Stevens is going to go with, which is the same starting five he went with for much of the year, the same starting five that, even though he wavered with it a bit against Chicago, he settled back into. That would be Isaiah, Bradley, Crowder, Amir Johnson, and Al Horford. I would not do that. I've been saying for a while, I think Jaylen Brown is a good energy boost. Defensively, he's been very good in this series. I mean, offensively, he was horrible the last couple of games, but he brings good energy. He brings good defense. He's a good enough rebounder. Amir Johnson really nets you nothing at this point in time. So I would be okay with a variety of guys in the starting lineup over Amir. I think Jaylen is the most realistic. I know Brad Stevens loves himself some Jonas Jerebko, but you know, Jerebko didn't even get off the bench these last couple of games. So I don't know how realistic he is. I expect it'll be Amir Johnson. I don't think that's the right call, and I haven't thought that's the right call all playoffs.
Most teams, Game 7, playoffs, but Game 7 specifically, you're going to ride your starters. You're going to put them out there, you know, 35-plus minutes. The Celtics are not most teams. How quick should Brad be to go to the bench tonight?
Oh, I think he's been pretty quick with it, and I think he'll continue to be quick with it. Jaylen's been the first guy off the bench the last couple of games. They go to Smart early. They've been getting Rozier in there pretty much to match up with whenever Brandon Jennings is on the floor on the other side. They'll go to Olynyk. So, I mean, look, I don't think Amir gets more than 5 or 6 minutes max if he runs with the starters. But I do think, despite disagreeing with who starts the game, I think Brad's done a pretty good job of getting into his bench early if he needs to.
What does it say about the Celtics team, though, that and specifically about Brad Stevens, that we're at this point in the season, we're a game away from the conference finals, and there's still discussion about rotations and starting lineup?
Well, it's the double-edged sword of the depth that they have, right? Like, on the one hand, depth helps you survive, especially over an 82-game schedule where there are injuries, where, you know, things pop up, whether it is you know, paternity leave for Al Horford, whether it is, I mean, Isaiah's sister, if that happened in the regular season, like, you're not going to have your whole team ready to go for 82 games. So I think their depth pays big dividends in the regular season. It's why they don't, you know, traditionally over the last couple of years go into this deep funk and they're able to pull out of it rather quickly. But I think the other side of that coin is sometimes there's almost too many options there for Brad. And there's no set rotation. There is an unsettled starting lineup because so many of the guys after Isaiah and Horford are similar to one another. You know, I mean, I think Avery Bradley is a better player than Marcus Smart, but there are similarities. You know, I think there are similarities between a lot of the guys they bring in off the bench. So I think that becomes the issue where you're mixing and matching and you're trying to find out who has the hot hand instead of just, hey, this is our rotation. We figured it out over 82 games. We've whittled it away. It's the playoffs now. We're giving our starters more time, but we still know who our bench guys are. I think the Celtics don't have that. And being unsettled, I think, goes hand in hand with why this team can be so inconsistent.
I'm interested to see specifically how they're going to manage Jay Crowder tonight. He's been up and down in these playoffs, but this series specifically, his three best games shooting percentage-wise are also the three games he's taken the most shots. Is Crowder a guy they need to feed early and often tonight? And if he's not hitting, should they be quick to take him out of the game?
Well, I don't know if you feed him, but I think one thing he's done well in this series when they've played well, and he even did it in Game 6, is he gets out and runs. You know, him and Bradley are the two guys who get out. They fill the lane. Isaiah does a nice job keeping his head up. And even off made baskets, I mean, they don't need misses to run. In fact, I thought they ran really well off of made baskets in game six for a stretch in the third quarter where the Wizards would score. They wouldn't get set defensively. The Celtics would get it into Isaiah. He'd lob it up for Bradley or Crowder up ahead of the pack, and it was an easy basket. And those are deflating. Those are demoralizing to a defense because all it is hustle. All you got to do is get back, and the Wizards were struggling to do that. So that's what I'd like to see out of Jay. I don't want him to pass on open looks because he's a three-point shooter. You know, I mean, and when I say that, that doesn't mean he's one of the best three-point shooters in the league or anything, but that's just what he shoots. He shoots threes and he shoots layups. That's his game. And I don't want him passing on open looks because he struggled. I don't think you want a player being in their head like that. I don't think they're going to have a short leash with him. He's one of their guys. I think you got to go down with the ship with Jay Crowder unless he's really in trouble or in foul trouble or something like that. But to get him going, I would like to see him out and running and getting those easy layups because I think that settles him in. And then I think the defense has to keep him honest, and that opens up some jump shots.
And then on the other side of the floor, it seems like in this series, if you focus on John Wall, Bradley Beal goes off. If you focus on Bradley Beal, they both go off. Wall was an absolute killer in Game 6. He hit the dagger. How do you manage defensively those two tonight if you're Brad Stevens? Who does Avery Bradley draw? Does he move around? Are you using the double team, et cetera?
I mean, I think they're hard to double because you just said it. They're two dynamic players. You know, it's easier to double Isaiah and ask Avery Bradley or Jay Crowder or even Horford to beat you because none of those guys are high-octane, explosive offensive players. I mean, the Wizards have two of them. So I think doubling becomes it becomes an issue because if you double Wall, he's going to find Beal or whomever all day long. And same thing with Beal. So I stick with Bradley on Wall as much as I can. I think that's been a good matchup. I don't think Bradley played him poorly on the game winner the other night. He gave him some space, but when you're as fast as John Wall is and you can get to the rim in the blink of an eye, I think he played him right. He got a hand in his face. I think Bradley's generally done a good job on Wall all series long, as well as you could expect. And then I think you're going to see a lot of Marcus Smart on Beal. When the Celtics have that three-guard lineup, they play it a lot to finish out games. They try to hide Isaiah on sometimes Beal defensively, but less so in crunch time. They try to hide him on Otto Porter. You know, they try to mix and match a little bit there. So I think the most you're going to see is Avery on Wall, and then in crunch time, I think you're going to see a lot of Smart on Bradley Beal, and I think that's the right way to play it because you can't double him.
Now, we know the history with these two teams. Maybe they'll both show up in black tonight. Who knows? This one could very well get chippy. Who does it favor if people start slamming underneath?
So I would have said the Celtics coming into the series. I don't think that's how it's played out. I think whenever it's gotten physical, whenever, you know, there's been a little bit of an edge to the games, I think it's generally been advantage Wizards. And I think they've been the ones who have pushed the envelope. I think Markieff Morris is a guy you have to watch closely. In game six, there were a lot of extracurriculars from him. He fell on top of Isaiah. He had the elbow to the nose of Jaylen Brown. Like, you see a lot of that. And I don't think the Celtics have responded well to it, which surprises me because I think they're a team that doesn't mind mixing it up. I think they're a team that is okay being physical and chippy. And I'm surprised that the series hasn't played out that way. And I'm surprised we're here at a game seven now saying it. I actually think that's favored the Wizards. And I don't know if they can do it on the road as well as they've done it at home, but I'd expect to see a little of that tonight.
Between the physicality of the series and then the issues with the clock at the end of game six, the NBA acknowledging that there should have been another second on, is there an extra focus on the officials tonight?
I mean, it's a game seven, so there always will be, but I'm not focusing on them. The second at the end of the game the other night, I don't think that makes a difference. I know Isaiah said he could have got another dribble. They were ready for him. I really genuinely don't think that makes a huge difference. And you know how it goes. If you lose, you blame the officials, whichever side you're on in a
right.
Game seven, if it's close. And if you win, you don't worry about them. So I think the Celtics are going to win this game. I thought they were going to win game six in Washington. I think they're going to win this game tonight. So I don't think we're going to be too worried about the officials in Boston.
Again, we're talking with Adam Jones of 98.5 The Sports Hub. 10 matchups this year between these two teams. The home team has won them all. You're picking the Celtics again tonight, you just said. Is the crowd really that much of a factor in this series?
I don't think it's been the crowd that's been a factor, because I don't think the crowd's a factor in Washington. I really don't. I don't think that's a hostile environment. I don't think it's a very loud crowd. I didn't think they got on Olynyk all that much in game four, which I've kind of detailed over the last week or so. I don't know that it's the crowd. There's something to Washington being at home, and I can't put my finger on what it is. I think in Boston, the Garden gets legitimately loud, and I think there is an environmental home court advantage. I don't know what the home court advantage is for Washington. They sleep well in their beds. They go out and party on the road. Like, I don't know what it is. They've been a poor road team all year. You know, the Celtics actually have been a pretty good road team all year long. They've just been really bad in the Verizon Center. And the Celtics also have been a really good home team. They play well at home. They played well at home in this series, not in the opening round against Chicago, but in this series. So, look, I don't know if it's the fans. I don't know if it's the atmosphere. I don't know if it's a comfort level. But I, whatever it is, I expect the Celtics to pull that out at the Garden tonight.
Keep it here. We will have more with Adam Jones, big picture Celtics stuff in 30 seconds. You're listening to Callin' It, brought to you by Snapcall Sports.
Callin' It is a Snapcall Sports production. Snapcall Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snapcall, the game within the game.
Welcome back to Callin' It. Alex Barth here. Adam Jones is on the phone with us from 98.5 The Sports Hub. We just broke down a little bit of Game 7 because we record the show on Mondays. We're going to have to play a little game of pick your path here. Remember those things when you were a kid? You know, go to page 68 if this, page 79 if that. So we're going to start off with if the Celtics win, we'll go with Adam Jones' prediction. If they lose, fast forward 5 or 10 minutes if you're listening to this later in the week. So I guess the first question, Jones, if they win, it's Cleveland. Rest versus rust. The Celtics have played 7 games. The Cavs haven't played in a week. Which advantage do you prefer?
I mean, I guess I'd rather be the more well-rested team, but really that's not my answer. I'd just rather be Cleveland. You know, I mean, I'd rather have the best player
in the world.
Yeah, I'd rather have their firepower and their talent. And I if it was Cleveland on 2 days rest versus the Celtics on 9 days rest, I wouldn't think much of it the other way. So look, I mean, I'd rather be rested than not. And, you know, I think the rust aspect gets overstated sometimes. I mean, I wouldn't be too worried about the Cavs being rusty any more than, you know, maybe the first 5 or 6 minutes of game one, and then they're locked right back in and it all levels out. So I guess I would go with rest, but my real answer is I would go with the talent, the firepower that Cleveland has.
We know it's an uphill battle. I think most people around here, I know green teamers is a term on your station, but most people around here, realistic, it's an uphill battle for the Celtics if they face Cleveland. What has to change from the first 2 rounds for them to have a shot in this series?
An injury to LeBron? I mean, I don't know. I don't know that the Celtics, realistically, even with home court advantage, can pull the series out. I don't think that's going out on a limb. I don't think that's a hot take. I think that's just no one's beaten Cleveland yet in the playoffs. And, you know, the Celtics have won some games against them the last couple of years, won each the last couple of years. But, you know, I don't know that Cleveland is worried about the Celtics one bit. I think they're worried about themselves. So, I mean, look, the Celtics need to keep making their shots. They need Isaiah to take over. They need Horford to be a matchup nightmare like he's been against Robin Lopez and against Marcin Gortat. I think that's going to be harder against Tristan Thompson and, to a lesser degree, Kevin Love, who's going to work Horford at the other end. They just need a lot of stuff to go their way, a lot of stuff to go right. They can't lose on the boards, you know. They need to keep LeBron relatively in check, which is hard to do, but then you can't let Love and Irving go off on top of that. I mean, there's a long, long laundry list against a team like Cleveland, which people were debating, can they flip the switch? Have they flipped the switch? I don't think that's a debate anymore. They look every bit as good as they did last year on the way to the title.
Would the Celtics at least have a chance to make it entertaining? Maybe bring us to a game six, take a couple of games deep into the final minutes?
So that I think they can do. I mean, home court advantage is big. The Celtics are good. I mean, they're a better team than the Wizards, no questions asked to me, which is why they should get to the Eastern Conference Final. And, you know, they're a team that does play hard. And I don't think they're gonna mail it in. I give Toronto half a pass against Cleveland because they were without, you know, if not their best player, their leader in Kyle Lowry in that series. I think that's why they mailed it in midway through. I mean, barring an injury or something like that to the Celtics, I don't see that being the case. So I can certainly see them taking a game. I think two would be about their max, but I don't think they're going to get swept, I'll tell you that.
Now the fun stuff. If the Celtics lose tonight and we have to go to the nuclear... Yeah, here we go. And I don't know if you saw this. This was before Game 6. Spike Eskin of WIP Radio in Philadelphia sent out a tweet, and I don't know what his reasoning for it was, but he basically said Brad Stevens is coaching for his job in Game 6. Now, the Celtics lost. You're not going to fire your coach before Game 7. Is Brad Stevens coaching for his job tonight?
No. I mean, God, no. I mean, he might be more plugged in than me, but I cannot imagine the Celtics would consider...
Because he was Eskin from Philly. He was sticking his convictions. He was going at people on Twitter convinced he was right. Do you even know where he could have got this from?
No. I mean, I know it was out there a little bit in the Bulls series. Just, hey, what happens? Is he on the hot seat? I mean, I think that's even too strong. I mean, now maybe Brad will start feeling a little pressure. I mean, I think the heat gets... I mean, and when I say the heat, I don't mean from management or ownership. I mean from the fan base. Maybe right. He'll finally start getting a little bit of that. You know, he won't be walking on water anymore, that sort of thing, but... No, I he's a good coach. I think he gets overrated with how good of a coach he is in Boston sometimes. But, you know, if he's not an elite coach, he is an above average, very good coach in the NBA. He's young. They've been on the right track. So, no, I don't. They're not pulling the plug on him. I can't see that.
We've got the lottery tomorrow, perhaps the two most important days the Celtics have had in quite some time. Number one pick, keep or trade.
Number one pick, keep or trade. I'll give you a bit of a cop-out answer. It depends on what they can do in free agency. But my preference would be to trade for a Butler or a George over signing someone like Gordon Hayward. So yeah. I guess that would lean me towards trade. I think there's a way where you can try to do both. You know, you can try to go the Hayward route and draft, but if you're going to pin me down on one, I would rather trade for a George or a Butler, even though you have to give up assets to do that. Then sign someone like Hayward. Just I think those two players are that much better than Hayward. And I just don't love the idea of putting the Butler Bulldogs back together here in Boston and bringing in former Brad Stevens players because he recruited them and coached them in college. I don't know if that's the right reason to bring in a guy like Hayward. I want to bring him in for basketball reasons, not, you know, to reassemble the team and have a bunch of good feelings. I want the talent out there. So it's real close. I like Fultz a lot. I also like Lonzo Ball. I don't know what kind of a fit he would be with Isaiah Thomas. I think Fultz could play alongside him, but I also don't want to sit here and wait for 3, 4, 5 years for LeBron to get old. I'd like for the Celtics to go at him. So I guess I would lean trade on that one.
You mentioned the Butler thing. It screams Chip Kelly just bringing all the former players back.
Yeah.
To get a guy like Paul George, and that's the name that I've really been looking at. We had this conversation at the trade deadline. Everybody had it. I guess you have to have it again, especially with how invisible he's been for the most part in the playoffs. Is Jaylen Brown untouchable this offseason?
I mean, he wouldn't be for me. I don't know how Danny Ainge thinks about it. He would not be untouchable for me. And I was never a big fan of the pick. He's contributed more and been better than I thought he would be as a rookie, and he definitely shot better than I thought. You know, that said, Brad Stevens has a quick hook with him for a reason. He has a lot of defensive lapses, which makes sense. He's 19, 20 years old. So I think that makes sense. But if that's the cost of doing business to get you a bona fide, legitimate star, then I would be willing to move on from him. I can't get inside Danny Ainge's head on that one. But I certainly would not have a problem with it.
Again, we're talking with Adam Jones of 98.5, the Sports Hub. Big, not just Celtics, big picture Boston stuff here. Bruins, most people thought were going to be a train wreck. They made it to the first round and got bounced. The Celtics are right where people thought they would be. If the Celtics lose tonight, so they lose in Game 7 of the Eastern Conference semis, who had the more encouraging season, the Celtics or the Bruins?
Ooh. I might go Bruins on that one. They've really developed a lot of young talent. They have the ability to make some moves in the offseason, though I think that'll be a big key in whether or not they continue to build momentum towards something bigger. I didn't know if the Bruins would be a playoff team. I didn't know they would develop young players this year. I mean, I have my hopes just like everyone, but I mean, they were encouraging. To me, if the Celtics lose, I'm not going to call their season a failure or anything like that. That feels too strong, but it's a bitter pill to swallow there at the end when they had a 2-0, Yeah, well, yeah, they had a 2-0 lead. They had a 3-2 lead. Game 7 at home. They're better than Washington. Like, all these things. They had Game 6 up 5 with 125 to go. I can't call that encouraging. And I thought they were the number 2 team in the East before the year started, which means they should be in the Eastern Conference Finals. So, look, the year was not a failure, but I think the Bruins, if it ends for the Celtics tonight, I think the Bruins had the more encouraging year.
Adam Jones of 98.5, thank you so much for coming on, taking the time. Hopefully we'll be talking to you about the conference finals next week.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Alex.
Colin, it is a Snap Call Sports production. Snap Call Sports is available for iPhone or Android download. Snap Call, the game within the game.
Welcome back to Callin' It. The NBA playoffs, yes, they've been exciting, but the NHL playoffs have been as expected, which is unexpected. You have an 8-seed cruising, and the President's Trophy winner is out. That is the Washington Capitals, a team that seems like year after year get embarrassingly bounced in the playoffs. How big's the fallout going to be this time? Craig Seiden joins us on the phone from Snap Call Sports. Craig, how you doing today?
Good, and yourself, Alex?
I'm doing well because we can finally legitimately have this conversation. Is Alex Ovechkin on the trading block? So, Craig, before we get into specifics, because I have some teams in mind, it was embarrassing for Washington. There's been talk that they'll blow it up, but there's blow it up and there's blow it up. What kind of changes are we looking at in our nation's capital?
I don't think big changes in terms of complete blow up and rebuild for Brian McClellan, who's the GM of the Capitals. You have Kevin Shattenkirk, who's going to be coming off the books, and he's most likely going to test free agent. According to the Washington Post, he wants to be the guy, number one center in a bigger role. He wouldn't mind coming back to the Capitals, but I don't see that happening. They won't be able to re-sign him. So he will most likely go to free agency. TJ Oshie wants to come back, but I don't think they'll be able to re-sign him either unless he takes a little bit of a discount. So there are a couple big guys coming off, and I also think you could potentially see a buyout for Brooks Orpik, which opens up the space for Evgeny Kuznetsov, who's an RFA, to re-sign, and he's going to get paid and rightfully deserves to. Jacob Vrana will most likely come up and fill that role. He's 21, still on the just about to finish his entry-level contract. And you also have to sign Nate Schmidt, who was their 6th, 7th defenseman this year, provides a lot of speed on the back end, and Dmitry Orlov, who played every minute of the postseason and was within their top three and will be a stout defenseman to come. Both Schmidt and Orlov, 25, so they have their best years ahead of them. So I don't really see a lot of too many changes, but that's going to be one of them. And also the rumor that Vegas will take backup goaltender Philip Grubauer in the expansion draft, who backed up Holtby. So there will be another position that Brian McClellan will need to address this offseason.
So let's say they do try to blow it up a little bigger, and the talk is true, and they're at least looking at offers for Ovechkin. In your mind, what should the Capitals be looking for as a return? Established players, prospects, draft picks, a combination? What is a team going to have to put together, just in general, before we get to specific teams to maybe grab Ovechkin?
I think a little bit of both. You look at Nashville and the teams that are still left, and especially Pittsburgh in the Final Four, a lot of them have gotten through based on role players. You look at Nashville with Colton Sissons in the bottom six of the forwards. You look at Rust Gensel, who were both third-round picks in the draft. You know, they've really come up and have stepped up for the Penguins, especially with Crosby being out of game. You know, Malkin's being Malkin. He's leading the playoffs in points at 19. But what they really need is some more role players. Is that really what helps the team go deep into the playoffs? If you look at all those Stanley Cup teams, the role players play a big role, scoring goals, big goals in key times, and shutting down the play, which the Capitals have had. And this was arguably their best team to date. But it's getting over that hump. And I think part of the issue was Holtby this postseason. You know, he was very uncharacteristic of him in the regular season. And when he came to Pittsburgh. I think it was just something mental about getting over that hump. There was a quote from one of the other day from Holtby's sports psychologist that said, the puck doesn't know how big the game is. So I think there is the issue there. And I think it's mostly mental. But in terms of blowing it up for a trade for Ovechkin, I would say draft picks, established young players to keep building for the future. And if they want to win now, they're going to have to make a big splash with somebody. But it's harder to make a bigger splash than Alex Ovechkin in this league.
So here's the one I have, obviously being from Boston, I've thought about the Bruins. And let me preface this by saying, I know the Bruins have a lot of youth, but the window is closing for Bergeron, Marchand, Rask, that core. Do you mortgage the future in order to get maybe one or two with those guys with Ovechkin? My hypothetical offer is, I mean, you got to spend big. McAvoy, Pasternak, and two or three firsts. You tell me if I'm too high, too low on point, whatever.
That's too much for the Bruins to mortgage to get for Ovechkin. Remember, Ovechkin's 30. So about he has four or five years left on his deal at 9.5. You're mortgaging McAvoy, who's going to be your number one defenseman for years to come, who's a puck moving defenseman with a wicked shot from the blue line. So I wouldn't move him because number one defensemen in this league are very, very hard to come by. He would be a do not trade for years and years to come. And you'd also want to be able to clear up some cap space so you can sign him to a long term future deal. Now, the thing with McAvoy is, yes, he had a great postseason, but you have to give him a chance to play regular season. He hasn't played a full 82 games yet, and it's a completely different animal when you're coming from college or juniors who play about 40 to 50 games for a season versus a full 82. Now, I will say that I do think he will hit the ceiling at one point, and his game will start to decline, but you need it to decline to get better so he can work harder. Pasternak, he was your best forward besides Marchand all year. He's somebody that you're going to want to build around. But I think I like the Pasternak, but I don't like the three first-round picks, because you look at the Rangers in New York, they are going to have their first first-round pick this season since 2012. Now, they've made a lot of moves and have gone to the Cup Finals in 2014, by just tinkering here and there. But in a couple of years, when Henrik Lundqvist is done and the team's going to start to teeter, they're going to have a massive decline towards the basement of the league because they've mortgaged their future too much. So I think it's a little too much, but not unreasonable. And it's a good starting price.
So we were talking off the air, and you had St. Louis as a team that could possibly be hypothetically in the mix. What would your move for Ovechkin to St. Louis look like?
I would say a first round and a third round for Ovechkin, plus David Perron, who was with Pittsburgh for a little bit, didn't really thrive much in the East, but he's a good way to clear some of that cap space for him. The one thing that I like about the fit for St. Louis is the style of play. Ovechkin likes to either stand up at the blue line or kind of grind it out down low. He doesn't have that game-breaking speed that the East has, especially the Metro with Pittsburgh, the Rangers. You know, that's a lot of what the game is going to. So St. Louis, he kind of fits their style of play a little bit. I would also like, I would take off, you know, that's who I would like to see him with. I think he'd be a great fit there. You know, he won't be the guy. It'll be Tarasenko's team. You know, it's like LeBron going to Miami. It was still Dwayne Wade's team, but LeBron really carried them. That's what I would think this situation would be. And it'd be easier to get through the West right now than it is through the East. The East is by far the better competition outside of Nashville right now, who's just steamrolling through the West, except for last night where they blew a 2-0 and a 3-2 lead and with Anaheim, who tied up the series.
So the one other discussion that's been had with Ovechkin, and if he doesn't play for the Capitals next year, this is my prediction, is that he's done with the NHL. He's talked in the past about how important it is to him to play internationally, to play in the Olympics, and we know about the ban from Bettman. NHL players, as of right now, won't play. he could go home, play in the KHL, pull a Kovalchuk, make just as much money, and still get to play in the Olympics. What do you think is a better chance if he's not in Washington this year? He's in another NHL sweater, or he's playing somewhere overseas?
Well, if he's going to leave Washington and it's not via trade, he will go to the KHL. The only thing is I don't really see that happening. The KHL is in a lot of trouble right now. Last time I looked, about 7 different teams haven't fully paid their players. They're having a lot of troubles financially, hence why a lot of the players are coming back to the NHL, like Kovalchuk will be coming back. Alexander Radulov last year came back. I thought you'll see more of a shift that way. You can promise all these all the money you want, but until they actually get paid, it's a completely different story. I would say probably towards the end of his career, he will go back like Pavel Datsyuk did last year, and his contract is still with, well, it's now with Arizona, but I would still think that Ovechkin is going to stay in the NHL. It's a bigger market for him. He's known for the NHL. He is the face of the NHL, and they will do everything in their power to not allow him to leave. Now, the thing with the Olympics is it's all a power struggle right now between the NHL and the IOC. So there's still time to get things worked out, even though the NHL says no. The IOC still thinks they have a chance to get the NHL to go, even though I don't think they will. And I think it's actually the right move for the NHL this time around to do it and then wait another 4 years to go to China, where the NHL wants to grow the game. So it's a little bit of a dance right now, but that's still a long ways away. But I don't see Ovechkin leaving the NHL until at least the end of his contract, and then maybe want to go play at home in front of his parents and his family like Pavel Datsyuk did. Now, what you could say is he could pull a Jágr, even though I don't think the style of play Ovechkin has is similar to Jágr's, because Ovechkin really likes to take the body as Jágr didn't. If you remember a while back, Jágr went home, played in the KHL for his hometown club for 3 or 4 years, and then came back to the NHL. I don't see either one of those happening. I think he's going to be in the NHL for a long, long time.
Craig Seiden of Snap Call Sports, thank you very much for coming on and taking the time.
And my pleasure, Alex, anytime. Thank you.
That is going to do it for this week's show. I'd like to thank Adam Jones of 98.5 The Sports Hub for coming on earlier, as well as Craig for indulging my Ovechkin trade sweet tooth. Next week on the show, we'll know the NBA draft lottery results so we can talk a little mock draft. That's always fun. Plus, the MLB hitting the quarter pole of their season, what's going on with the Red Sox, and what's going on with everybody else as well. Might as well touch on that. Until then, I am Alex Barth. Thank you for listening. This has been Callin' It.
You've been listening to Callin' It with Alex Barth. This episode has been brought to you by Snap Call Sports. Snap Call, the game within the game. Available for iPhone or Android.